Voices of Vascular, because perspective changes everything.
Welcome to Voices of Vascular. I'm Greg Shears, a pediatric anesthesiologist and intensivist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and the host of this session. Using animals in research is a very controversial topic that many people feel passionate about on both sides of the debate. It is a highly regulated area of research with significant oversight on both a local and national level. If you're a patient, you may not be aware that medical devices are often first tested on animals. Today, we're going to delve into some of the issues associated with animal studies. With me today, I'm honored to have Dr. Mark Stranz. He's a pharmacist with many years of experience with studying how medical devices and medications could potentially affect humans by first studying animals. So, Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Greg.
I'd like to jump right in now. We understand that this is an extremely controversial topic, and we're going to be very sensitive to that. So this isn't meant to be a debate so much as a helping of understanding. Mm-hmm. And that's why when I titled this session, Animal Studies, Why They're Still Necessary, I wanted to kind of build a conversation around that. My question to you is, why is there still a need to use animal studies?
The need is related primarily to the fact that we don't have better alternatives yet. We're working on them, but we haven't gotten there yet. It's an issue. But until we have something that can predict the activity of a drug in the human body, given all the circumstances that occur in that situation, we have to have something else. And in this case, it has traditionally been animals. It's developed that way, and now we have to change our understanding and determine that we can use other methods.
So I'm going to direct a sub-question of the same thing to the vascular access side.
Yes.
And what is it about animal studies that are necessary to understand the future human interaction with, let's say, access devices?
Sure. We have the ability to look at access devices in single situations, exposed to a layer of cells, in computer systems, and say that, well, you know, this length may be better on this on with blood volumes and things like that. The problem is we don't have any way to bring all of those factors together that represents the access device in a vessel with blood flow and with all the different things that go on in the body and in each individual person. So in order to get that final model, which is as close as we're probably going to get to the human, then we have to use animals.
I see. Tell me, what efforts are in place to limit or avoid using animals in medical research?
Well, I think the vast majority of researchers are trying not to use animals. Honestly, using animals in research is probably the most expensive piece of it. And there's been a great deal of, if you will, concern and care in using these animals, because if they aren't happy animals, well cared for, well fed, et cetera, then they're going to respond abnormally to the tests that are done. So we need, you know, just like we want happy patients, you know, we want happy animals in this sense. It is probably the best way to do it at this point. We don't have another model. We don't have a computer model. We don't have a layer of cells that can produce the results that we have to be sure that we're not going to introduce a product into a human that is harmful.
What role does government play in animal research?
The government has a very large role. The FDA has established requirements for the use of animals in the studies that they require. The American Veterinary Society has a whole set of rules that talk about the roles that veterinarians should be playing in this. And again, one of the requirements is that the committees that oversee the use of animals in research studies has a practicing veterinarian on them. And the role is, you know, that committee to be sure that, first of all, that the work being done makes sense. It's worth doing in an animal. It's paraphrased, but that's exactly what it means. And then if we do it, that the animal, it receives the best of care throughout the course of the study.
So now bringing it down to the local level where mm-hmm. most of us operate, so what is the oversight of animal research within an institution?
Well, as a trial is being approved, you're going to come forward with all of the things done in that trial, in the study. It's part of the approval process by the review committee of a university or somewhere. All these trials have to be reviewed. And on that consideration is if you're going to use animals, then there's criteria that we follow that are established through a committee that is, again, looked at by the FDA, by the universities, you know, externally, as well as other groups. And we have to meet all of those criteria in terms of care of the animals and things like that through the process, beginning to end.
I must say, as a researcher myself and someone that has been involved in multiple animal studies, I am pleased to say over the last 25 years what an improvement there has been regarding the level of supervision, quality of care that's provided mm-hmm. at the local level. I've been very impressed by the knowledge level of both the veterinarians and the technicians that are overseeing care for the animals and really being physically present during the research. I mean, literally right there in the room as we're working through whatever issue there is to make sure that things are done as perfectly and by the book and as compassionately as can be. So I have to say, with all the attention that this issue has brought, both positive and negative, mm-hmm. and the need for animal studies, as you say, because we don't have a good substitute yet, the quality of oversight is phenomenal, and I've been very pleased. I've heard people complain, oh, you know, it's so difficult. But truthfully, if you're going to do something right, you have to go through things by the book. And at the end, you have to feel good that you've done something worthwhile. This hasn't been meaningless. You've made sure it was absolutely necessary. You've eliminated all the lower risk or non-animal possibilities. Mm-hmm. And you've done this properly. So in your heart, you can feel at least that you've done all of those things and the end product is of the highest quality that it can be.
And I agree with you. I think that we have put into place as many substitutes for using animals as we have come to understand that the data produced by those. So we're using computer simulations for drugs. We now know that some of those computer simulations can predict that a drug isn't going to have, it's either not going to work or it's going to have side effects potentially based on the computer analysis. They never make it. So there's no animals that have to be tested because we removed the drug before it went to animal testing. The same thing goes with cell cultures and things like that. We haven't been able to create for like vascular. We haven't been able to create a freestanding blood vessel that we can test. But we do know with the cellular levels that we can say, you know, 2 decades ago, we were doing tests on endothelial cells that determined that a drug might be toxic. Some of those have then been carried forward into studies and have changed the way the study was done. So we are using that information, and it's becoming better and better as time goes on.
So maybe another way to think about this, or I believe what you're saying, is that we may not have eliminated animal studies, but we've helped to reduce them because there's been some pre-screening through other methods to then get down to specifics that are, you know, not cannot be otherwise discerned in any other way.
Exactly. There are the FDA, yeah, veterinary societies, et cetera, all require that trials look at three basic processes. One is called replacement. Can we do something other than test with animals? Reduction, which is, as you said, it's doing less or using fewer animals to do the same thing, things like that. Doing it using animals less. And the actual one is refinement, which means the quality of care the animals get, making sure that their pain is managed if there is any, things like that. So all of those three R's are required in all of these trials. Each one of them is intended to take care of the animals.
Have there been any helpful statements from government agencies or animal advocate agencies that can help guide us or reassure us as we're on the right track?
There have been. The FDA put together and continues to conduct meetings. They created a model, if you will, for their activities called a strategic roadmap for establishing new approaches to evaluate the safety of chemicals and medical products in the United States. That is very specifically intended to remove animals from the testing process as we continue to develop and believe in alternative methods. Know that those will represent humans safely and not introduce something that that's unexpected. So that's what the FDA has done, and that continues to go on, and they're pushing for exactly those changes. What's very interesting is that the Humane Society came out at the end of last year on an article called Replacing Animal Tests to Improve Safety for Humans. And the statement they made that caught my attention is, we must acknowledge that predicting the safety of medicines is an enormous challenge and that a major obstacle to the paradigm change is a lack of confidence in the new methods. And it's that confidence that we have to continue to develop.
So in preparation for our podcast here, I did a fair bit of reading and tried to look at successes and failures and things from the use of animals and trying to get a sense of that. I didn't realize, as an example, that something like 95% of all animals used for medical research are rodents. Yes. That's by far the predominant one. And I've noticed certainly in my over my career a reduction in higher level animals and their use, which I seems very appropriate. But I also just saw an article about the trouble with let's say trying to develop HIV vaccines in non-human primates. And the misinformation that one might get from that didn't translate. And I'm wondering, do you have a general sense of how translatable the animal data is going then to humans? Is there a way to quantify that? I know that's complicated. It probably is on an individual disease or object standpoint, but can you give us a sense of that?
Because... And again, I could give you a sense of it, and then I can speak specifically to the things that I do. Rodents, rats, have about 97% of our genetic makeup. We are able to use them, to predict what might happen in humans. We can actually instill the chimeric rodents have... Human.
I'm going to pause there. What does that mean? Because I bet a lot of our audience say chimeric.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, chimeric basically means that we have introduced human genes into the animal and it grows, it exists, and it enables us then to test in a rodent how the drug, product, et cetera, device may react in a human. It's much closer than just a rat by itself or a mouse by itself, et cetera.
I see. So so then with my question, the translatability of that data, can you, let's say, give me an example of where it gave us an unanticipated, either fantastic, was incredibly helpful, or really misled us. Can you give me some examples if you have any?
In the world that I look at, which is like the tolerance of drugs in the vascular system, we began with rats, rat tails to be exact. That was not exactly reproducible data. They're very small, and trying to introduce a needle, into a rat tail vein created enough trauma to probably skew any results we were going to get. They moved to rabbit ears, and the data was much better. And much of the information year to date that we have is based on rabbit studies, rabbit ear data that was developed in the late 80s. And it doesn't translate 100%, but it translates enough to be able to predict which drugs are going to cause problems in the veins, pain, things like that. The reasons we have to take those IVs out, the access devices out. So we're able to predict enough with that. It's not complete, because it's not really a model of the human vascular system in a rabbit ear, because those vessels are very small too, and therefore, you know, not as tolerant. But it was good enough to make some predictions and to realize that we needed to know more in a better vascular system.
A question that you just brought to my mind as part of this, part of your explanation, was, with subsequent human research, is there a... let's say carrying on to, you know, the human phase and understanding with a device or a medication, will they hone in on questioning a specific area that, well, there's something came up, let's say in a rabbit model or a mouse model that was of concern, maybe not tremendously to stop, but here it's showing up. Will that be emphasized then? Does it translate over in the human research so that that's paid more attention to or scrutinized more?
Yes,
or how does that work?
It does in several ways. You know, I mentioned before, when we do the endothelial cell level, these are tissue layers of cells that are grown on a surface. We expose them to therapeutic levels of drugs. Some of those cells die. And we then realize that this drug has toxicity, so we need to be very careful of what dose we give. That's some preliminary information. It hasn't necessarily been able to translate totally into humans, but at least tells us we need to look out for this drug and be sure that we're watching the serum levels when we begin to give them to animals and to humans. In the same way, we come up with other problems, you know, with if it's causing damage in the animal model, when it's introduced into the blood vessels, then it's likely to cause that same damage in humans. So again, it's predictive if it's not just the final information we need.
Do you have any examples where animal research has really failed to detect harm in humans?
Well, I think most people know the thalidomide issues, where we were using, this is toxicology testing.
Yeah.
Probably the largest use of rodents is in toxicology testing, because we're trying to figure out the exact dose at which the damage is done and things like that. And the presumption is that what's toxic to an animal is toxic to a human. Well, thalidomide, which is, you know, causes horrendous birth defects, didn't cause any problems in animals. So lesson learned. So that's not necessarily the best model there. And that's been quoted on and off, is that, well, it's not reproducible. In that particular situation, it wasn't. But had we used these chimeric, the ones with the different tissue in them from humans, in those rodents, then we would have been able to detect it. We just didn't know, and at that time, couldn't do it.
So I'm curious, is there anything on the horizon that will help further reduce the need for animal research or further improve upon what we're currently doing?
Yes. The computer models that are out there are becoming more and more sophisticated as we give them more and more data. It's phenomenal what those programs can do and predict. And it's helping drug companies define what's going to work, what's not going to work on a predictive basis. It gets better and better every year because we have more and more information, which is what a computer needs. It's just like everything else. It's like the one, it learned to play chess because it played a lot of chess games. It's the same way with trying to reduce human physiology. You know, so, and again, some of these ex vivo, outside of the body situations, we're getting better and better, you know, models of blood vessels or organs, et cetera, outside of the body. And as each of those becomes sophisticated enough to be predictive, it's fewer animals that need to be tested.
Is there, in closing, is there anything that you would like to tell the listeners to sort of summarize or added things that we haven't covered?
What I would say is that everything in science and research is moving toward what are called human relevant methods of safety testing, trying to drive it toward the human, not toward animals, but toward the human. How do we replicate the environment in the human body most closely to be predictive about the outcome of these drug trials? I believe that eventually we'll get there, just because of the sophistication of some of this work.
It's so important. As someone that has worked on numerous different models to try to mimic the human situation in order to understand some interaction, it's the better the model, the more you can trust it, and the more useful it is ultimately. So I'm glad for all the progress in this area, the reduction in need for animals, and that we continue to work to try to optimize this for the betterment of keeping humans and animals safe. So, Mark, I want to thank you so much for speaking to us on this very controversial topic. This is Greg Shears. Thank you all for listening in. And I hope you visit Voices of Vascular website for other very interesting topics. Goodbye.
That's it for this week's episode. Thank you to the Voices of Vascular team and Vega Media Studios. If you haven't already, you can subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and you can find it on voicesofvascular.com. Also, if you're enjoying listening to us, we'd love it if you would leave us a review. It really helps listeners discover the series.